The North Carolina Reading Service presents this following program for our blind and print-impaired listening audience. It's the Indie Week, your independent, and it's read today by John Federson. This issue dated to April the 17th of 2025. Thank you very much, musicians. You can, of course, wait back in the green room, and we'll get you out just before the end of the broadcast today. Thank you. Off you go. Very good, wheeling that grand piano after them. All right, let's get started with our issue. First article, Durham is launching a loan program to build more ADUs. It's piloting this program to support the development of accessory dwelling units as part of its efforts to expand and diversify the city's housing stock. Housing, of course, is a central issue throughout the Triangle. Just last week, Durham Mayor Leonardo Williams and Raleigh Mayor Janet Cowell commiserated over the region's housing challenges during a panel discussion with the journalist Atlantic journalist Derek Thompson, whose new book, Abundance, offers a sharp critique of U.S. housing policy. A flood of new housing units is in the pipeline, but Durham is still woefully behind on meeting its housing needs. The number of residents who are all cost-burdened by housing is in the tens of thousands, says Reginald Johnson, the city's director of community development. For the city to meet its goals, residents need a diversity of options when deciding where to live. Accessory dwelling units, also known as ADUs, are one such option. Johnson said we need more different types of housing and more availability of housing that is smaller in terms of their structure. This pilot is just one tool in the toolbox that we're exploring. The city has not set a benchmark for how many units it expects to get out of this pilot. The $1.75 million allocated to the program supports gap funding and administrative costs, so the amount of housing that gets built will depend largely on what other financing is pulled together for the initiative. Interested homeowners have a few hurdles to clear should they choose to participate in the program. They must live in Durham. They must own the property where the ADU is built. And they must cap rents at 80% of the area median income. In addition, homeowners get a 30-year loan with a low interest rate to build this additional unit. There have been amendments to the city's Unified Development Ordinance over the past few years by the Planning Department, and they have opened the door for more construction of ADUs in Durham in the form of so-called mother-in-law suites on the top of a family garage or tiny homes tucked into backyards. Topher, and let's see, this is... We don't know who Topher is. Topher Thomas, founder of Coram Houses, a local development firm focused on building ADUs, has been an advocate for the adoption of new design ordinances. He says the city's pilot program could help serve more than one population in need, saying, "I'm excited about the potential of this program to increase awareness of the power of ADUs as a tool for creating accessible housing for the people who live in them, and also as a way for homeowners to generate sustainable income by sharing their land. My hope is that this low-interest capital becomes a real pathway to capital access for folks who've traditionally been excluded from it." Bringing ADUs to other parts of Durham has been well received by the community, says Johnson. One of the goals for the pilot, which is part of the city's Forever Home Durham Housing Initiative, is to create a proof of concept that can be replicated across the different neighborhoods in Durham. Johnson says the concept is very popular, particularly for those that may have land in their backyard but don't have the financial capacity to build an ADU. "We don't have enough housing, and that pushes up the cost. So to the extent that you can create more and diverse housing, you have more opportunities for people to rent. But it's not time for interested homeowners to sign up just yet. First City staff have released a request for proposals, that's an RFP, a request for proposals to hire an administrator who would oversee this $1.7 million set aside for the program and coordinate with homeowners. Who are the possible applicants? Will they include individuals or groups like community development, financial institutions, and architecture firms? The deadline to submit proposals for the RFP is May the 16th. Afterwards, those proposals will be reviewed by staff before getting a final sign-off from the City Council before the end of the summer. A longer article now from April 15th. Derek Thompson talks about abundance with Raleigh and Durham mayors. And I referenced that in the previous article. A new book titled Abundance from the national journalists Ezra Klein and Derek Thompson has been a topic du jour around water coolers, local coffee shops, and even city halls since its release last month. The author's proposed remedy for issues like America's housing scarcity and stalled scientific breakthroughs has captivated a wide swath of the electorate, from Democrats and progressives to moderate Republicans and libertarians alike. On Thursday, an audience gathered at the historic Hayti Heritage Center to hear Thompson, who currently lives in Chapel Hill, in conversation with two of the Triangle's most important decision-makers, Mayor Janet Cowell of Raleigh and her Durham counterpart, Leonardo Williams from Durham. The conversation was moderated by Blair Reeves of Carolina Forward, a left-leaning advocacy group based in Carrboro. As indie writers who cover growth, development, and local government, we were curious what our mayors, who rarely make appearances together, thought of abundance and how they might take inspiration from it to run their respective cities. By the way, these are Chloe Courtney Bowl and Justin Laidlaw are the two indie writers who wrote this article. We wanted to hear them wrestle with some of the more challenging questions posed in this book. Why is it so hard to get housing built here? How much community engagement is too much? What would it take to make our local government truly efficient and not in a Musk-y way? Instead, the mayor's contributions to the discussion were fairly surface level, barring a few moments of candor. For adherence to an abundance mindset, Klein and Thompson's book delivers good and bad news about local governments. The good news is that, in Thompson's words, local politics is where we have the biggest opportunity to make a difference. The bad news, according to the authors, is that many Democrat-run cities are so bogged down by layers of cumbersome bureaucracy, they have failed to build housing and mass transit, key ingredients to urban life that help working people thrive, and are becoming increasingly expensive and unequal as a result. The book encourages Democrats to respond to the Trump administration's politics of scarcity with a more positive, expansive politics of abundance, more housing, more public transport, more clean energy, and less procedural clutter that gets in the way of achieving these goals. In his opening spiel, Thompson laid out what he sees as the motivating issue for a majority of American voters: unaffordability. He said leaders across the country needed to counter the dearth of housing stock in the U.S. by reversing policy decisions made throughout the 20th century and eliminating barriers to production, thus creating a more affordable market. Quote, "When I think about abundance at the local level, I think it's really important for me to think about the courage to pursue the goals we find most important. And to me, when I look across the country, housing is just the most important goal." Residents of the Triangle, of course, are no strangers to the housing crunch. City council meetings are packed, sometimes overrun, with folks sounding off to their local representatives about how to manage growth responsibly. Many residents want more affordable housing, but not necessarily in their backyard, and more public services, preferably without the corresponding tax increase. They've spent years advocating for more citizen input in government, not less. This flavor of resident, Thompson said, has a penchant for drawing too narrow a circle of care around themselves and neglecting what's going on outside of it. Explaining, sometimes you'll see people say, I'm against that development within the city because if you build a house there, you're going to have to chop down those 10 trees. That's compelling if all you can see are those 10 trees. That seems on its face to be anti-environmental. What that person can't see are the 1,000 trees that have to be cut down when the 50 units that would otherwise be built as a dense apartment building are instead built in some exurban development. This type of convoluted logic, Klein and Thompson argue, is primarily a feature of Democrat-run cities. In America's biggest metros, San Francisco, Seattle, New York, Atlanta, L.A., the decline of housing construction has made life for middle- and lower-class Americans all but impossible. Thompson said, I think too many people in the working class have felt just like they can't make a life in many of America's most productive and richest cities, which tend to be governed by Democrats. Cowell and Williams cities fit the mold. Raleigh has a housing shortage of some 37,000 units by Cowell's estimate. Durham, too, is growing faster than it can build. Both places are becoming increasingly unaffordable for long-time residents. Williams said that's where the pain points come in. But, you know, either the people who live here already will pay for growth, or we expand the tax base and we share that wealth. That is what I spend most of my time doing, trying to communicate how growth is necessary and how we can also give pain pills for the growth as well. Amid the dire need for increased housing and more robust services to support a growing population, the mayors acknowledged that all the red tape they have to navigate to get things done in their respective cities can be maddening. Cowell confided to Thompson, I just love making decisions, and the amount of process at all levels of government drives me nuts. Your book was like therapy for me. Williams was even more candid in his assessment of the city of Durham's bureaucracy, describing the typical progression as get yelled at, do community engagement, and die in the process. Reeves, the moderator, asked the mayors about the biggest challenges they face in managing their growth, but mostly touted their successes instead. Cowell acknowledged Raleigh's critical housing shortage, but pointed out the city council has approved 3,000 new units for construction since she was sworn in as mayor in December. I think we should have tilted more toward results than process in this area, she said. Oh, and a prestigious nonprofit just named Raleigh the best performing metro area in the country. Williams noted that Durham is, quote, one of the best run cities in America. That's an accolade awarded by Wallet Hub. And boasted vaguely, vaguely, we are on the cusp of our next renaissance. He elevated the development of the Discover Durham nonprofit offshoot Durham Next as a success story for cutting through red tape in the service of building future capital assets like Williams' envisioned Innovation Center, a project estimated at roughly $500 million. At one point in the conversation, Reeves quipped to the mayors, we're not going to bring up the light rail today? Please don't, replied Williams, eliciting a burst of strained laughter from the audience, and so the panelists did not discuss how the Triangle's transit agency has tried and failed 3 times to deliver on a large-scale rail project for the region, the type of project that nests right in the intersection of economic growth, science, and technology that Klein and Thompson lift up in their book. The present dismantling of the federal bureaucracy in pursuit of so-called efficiency looms large in the background of any conversation about abundance. Funding for many of the projects centered in the agenda, mass transit, scientific discovery, clean energy, requires serious federal investment to build at scale. Investment that runs counter to the current administration's vision of the future. As we walked away from the discussion at Hetai, the utopia that abundance hopes to create felt like a parallel universe. But the panelists remained optimistic about the influence local government has over its own destiny. Both Raleigh and Durham can make strides at the local level toward building more housing and connecting the communities through public transit, and have. Thompson said, Trump is trying to execute a kind of ideological purge of government, and science and global health are getting caught in the crossfire. I think there are governors and mayors and city councils that have an extraordinary amount of power to determine their housing policies and their growth policies and transit policies and how they build and manage growth. And while Donald Trump is doing a lot of incredibly chaotic things on a day-to-day basis, I don't think those chaotic things eclipse the power that a lot of local governments have. Courtney Bowl, one of the previous authors, has written this article saying Raleigh aims to create 1,345 affordable housing units and reduce unsheltered homelessness to, quote, functional zero by 2030. 9 years ago, Raleigh set an aspirational goal of creating 5,700 affordable housing units by 2026. Today, with less than a year to go before this deadline, the city is about two-thirds of the way there, with 3,800 units. Creating and preserving affordable housing in Raleigh has gotten harder since 2016, thanks to a steep rise in both property values and the cost of building. Despite an $80 million affordable housing bond passed in 2020 and missing middle zoning reforms codified in 2021, demand for affordable units continues to far outpace supply. Today, the city estimates that more than a third of Raleigh households are cost burdened, meaning they spend 30% or more of their income on housing every month. Countywide, about 1,400 people are experiencing unsheltered homelessness, and there's a staggering shortage of 60,000 affordable units. Against this backdrop of acute need, city staff are drafting an affordable housing plan for the next 5 years. It sets this goal of creating or preserving 1,300 affordable units by 2030, and reducing this unsheltered homelessness to functional zero so that instances of it are, quote, rare, brief, and non-recurring. At a work session on Tuesday, the Raleigh City Council previewed the new plan and received an update on the city's affordable housing efforts to date from Emila Sutton, director of the Department of Housing and Neighborhoods. Sutton told the council members, the city's affordability is influenced by housing demand, housing supply, development costs, as well as household income and market shifts. Population growth and limited affordable supply have combined to create a crisis that is fueling hopeless homelessness in our community. There is no single solution to this issue. She explained to the council that the 2020 affordable housing bond is divided into different spending buckets, $28 million for public-private housing partnerships, $24 million for gap financing for low-income housing tax credit projects, $16 million for site acquisitions, and $6 million for home repairs, $6 million for home buyer assistance. The city has spent $56 million worth of that bond so far. That money has funded the creation of 890 affordable units through these partnerships and the gap financing, the acquisition of land for more than 300 new units, and home buyer assistance or repairs for an additional 107. The city has 1 year left to spend that remaining $24 million of the bond. But according to Sutton, Raleigh will need far more money than that to realize these housing goals by 2030. City Manager Marshall Adams David said during the work session that city staff are already discussing when to bring forward another bond or penny tax for affordable housing. Raleigh's new affordable housing plan, which only exists in a draft form for now, includes an array of new tools and strategies to increase the housing stock and reduce homelessness. These include streamlining affordable housing development by simplifying the permit and review process, expanding the city's fast-track program for constructing accessory dwelling units, those ADUs, incentivizing mixed-use development with a new funding model, which city staff and a consultant are working on, expanding rental assistance for low-income homeowners, exploring the community land trust model, exploring zoning changes that increase the housing variety, addressing the root cause of unsheltered homelessness, which is housing scarcity, offering incentives to private landlords to participate in affordable housing and homelessness prevention programs, and creating a flexible fund to assist residents experiencing homelessness with expenses like housing application fees, security deposits, and the first and last month's rent. The city's new goal of creating 1,300 affordable units in the next 5 years translates to about 270 units per year. That's less ambitious than the previous target of 570 per year. The new goal reflects the amount of production the city has been able to deliver in recent years and the higher cost of construction, said Sutton. At the end of that presentation, District C Councilmember Corey Branch asked her about the main obstacles to achieving these affordable housing goals, and she replied, "It's really just a resource game. The city has done an amazing job of setting up this infrastructure to get units on the ground, and so it's just a matter of how do we maintain that momentum, and that's really a question of resources." All right, we've had that on homelessness and residents around the Triangle area. I'm going to shift gears now for an article that was printed on April the 2nd about a Chapel Hill lab which is facing new threats 5 years after the COVID pandemic. "The Barrick Lab doesn't look like much from the outside," writes Matt Hartman. "Certainly not like a central node in a once-in-a-generation global event. At one of his laboratories, tucked away in a Gillings School of Public Health building on the UNC Chapel Hill campus, the only sign is taped to the window near a notice about trash collection. A name plate nearby is blank, minus a bumper sticker for the unincorporated community of Little Switzerland, a postcard and a sticker of a bat just below. Over spring break, almost 5 years to the day after North Carolina's first COVID-19 shutdowns began, the hallway outside was mostly abandoned to cardboard and styrofoam boxes that once held supplies, now distributed across the labs. Humble as it may seem, this lab and its principal investigator, Ralph Barrick, are central to the story of COVID-19, as well as the distrust of science that has grown in its wake. As federal research funding becomes a central issue of the Trump administration, there may not be a more important nor disputed test case in the country. Perhaps the world's foremost expert on coronaviruses, Barrick and his collaborators helped roll out the first FDA-approved COVID-19 treatment, the existing antiviral remdesivir, then helped develop another, molnupiravir. Then Barrick helped develop and test the Moderna vaccine. That was spearheaded by a Hillsborough native and one of Barrick's former PhD students. The work earned him global praise, as well as the North Carolina Awards, the state's highest civilian honor, and the University of North Carolina System's Max Gardner Award, given to faculty who have made the greatest contribution to the welfare of the human race. But it also brought intense scrutiny and placed Barrick's lab at the center of global investigations and congressional testimony about the origins of COVID-19, as well as conspiracy theories about the lab's role in the pandemic. Last year, a House Select Committee investigating the origins of COVID deposed Barrick on his research. At a Senate hearing on National Institute of Health funding in China, Senator Rand Paul accused him of working with the Wuhan Institute of Virology to create, quote, super viruses. Robert Redfield, director of the Center for Disease Control and Prevention when the pandemic began, told podcaster Dana Parrish, quote, there is a real possibility that the virus's birthplace was Chapel Hill, calling Barrick, quote, the scientific mastermind behind it. Now, multiple bills have been introduced in Congress that would likely ban the genetic engineering research Barrick is known for. Another would prevent research contracts with labs in countries of concerns, like China, where Barrick collaborated with the Wuhan Institute for years. Meanwhile, the Trump administration is seeking to slash National Institute of Health funding for research. Barrick's lab is one of North Carolina's largest recipients of such funding, and he's brought in millions from the NIH over his career, including a $65 million grant in 2022. A report in The Atlantic suggested that research into mRNA vaccines, like the Moderna one Barrick supported, could be targeted for cuts. The outcome of those policy debates won't just shape Barrick's lab, they will shape North Carolina's biomedical industry and how the world prepares for future pandemics. Barrick and UNC Chapel Hill Public Health School declined to comment for this story, but he warned in his House deposition last year that cracking down on science could have consequences for U.S. competitiveness. Quote, there has to be some refinement and consideration for the long-term impact of those regulations on scientific leadership, our economy, the biosecurity field, the biosafety field, and entrepreneurship, innovation, and discovery, he said. If you close all that down, microbiology is gone to China. And they have a 10-year plan to be number one, and we're helping them. Barrick, now 70, was raised in New Jersey but moved to North Carolina in 1972 when he accepted a full scholarship to join the State University swim team. His CV still lists his ACC championship and records in five events. He graduated with a zoology degree, then stayed in Raleigh to complete his Ph.D. in microbiology at NC State. After postdoc in California, he joined the Chapel Hill faculty in 1986 and has been there ever since. He was happy to spend his career in the, quote, scientific backwater of coronavirus research. Epidemiologist and science writer Dan Werb wrote in a profile in Time, far from the glare of public opinion, Barrick could work at his own pace. That topic became less of a backwater when SARS epidemic hit China in 2003, then again when MERS caused another epidemic in the Middle East in 2012. Both diseases are caused by coronaviruses. A few years later, Barrick began to sound the alarm about the threat of a global coronavirus pandemic. He had already discovered that the virus family was able to mutate and jump between species, so he began looking at whether some strains present in bats and other animals might soon be able to infect humans. The result was a 2015 paper in Nature arguing that a SARS-like cluster of circulating bat coronaviruses shows potential for human emergence. To prove the point, Barrick pushed the genetic engineering of viruses forward. For the Nature paper, he took the genetic code that enables some coronavirus to infect humans, that's the spike protein, and spliced it into strains that didn't have it. When the resulting viruses, called chimeras, infected human cells, Barrick had proof that there was a pool of coronaviruses that were only one mutation away from jumping to humans and creating a deadly outbreak. That strategy was immediately controversial. Barrick's work is often described as, quote, gain-of-function research. The precise meaning of that term is widely contested. Generally, it means altering organisms to give them abilities they don't have in nature, like engineering them to grow faster or become more contagious. Barrick has said that that study didn't qualify as gain-of-function research under NIH definitions, but other scientists still felt the benefits were not worth the risks of creating a potential pandemic pathogen. Virologist Simon Wayne Hobson told Nature at the time, if the virus escaped, nobody could predict the trajectory. Barrick disagreed. In his deposition last year, he argued that not only is gain-of-function research broadly defined necessary to understand emerging viral threats, but also to develop drugs to combat them. Because viruses often weaken when they jump across species, they can be less virulent in lab mice than in humans, making drug and vaccine candidates look more effective than they would actually be in humans. Engineering a stronger version of the virus may allow for more accurate testing. Barrick told MIT Technology Review, I would ask critics if they had identified any broad-spectrum coronavirus drugs prior to the pandemic, like his lab did. Can they point to papers from their labs documenting a strategic approach to develop effective pan-coronavirus drugs that turned out to be effective against an unknown emerging pandemic virus? As soon as evidence of a concerning new respiratory disease emerged in late 2019, global health leaders reached out to Barrick. He was part of the group that named the virus that causes COVID-19, now officially referred to as Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome Coronavirus 2, or SARS-CoV-2. In February 2020, he met with Anthony Fauci, then director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, and head of the United States COVID response, to discuss the outbreak and chimeras, according to one of his collaborators. When Duane Caneva, the Department of Homeland Security's chief medical officer, added Barrick to an email thread where national experts discussed the emerging crisis, he wrote, it does contain some attempts at humor, so, for example, Ralph, don't be surprised to references that you belong on the Mount Rushmore of coronavirus experts. I love humor, responded Barrick. Initial reports stated the virus originated in a wet market selling live animals in Wuhan, China, but concerns were increasing among some scientists and U.S. officials that COVID may have leaked from a virological research lab, possibly Wuhan Institute. Zheng Li Shi, a researcher there, was a co-author in his 2015 Nature paper. Shi and Barrick had also collaborated on the grant proposal to the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency for studies on the specific genetic element making SARS-CoV-2 so infectious. Though the proposal was denied, and both Barrick and the principal investigator, Peter Daszak, said the research was never completed, its existence fueled debate. The biologist Alina Chan told The Intercept, this definitely tips the scales for me toward the likelihood that COVID leaked from a lab, and I think it should do that for many other scientists, too. scrutiny of Barrick's research has also birthed some baseless theories that COVID was purposefully released as a bioweapon or as a way to profit from the drugs that helped end the pandemic. Those led to death threats that forced the Barrick lab to tighten security in 2023. He has largely stayed out of the spotlight since. The assembly contacted more than a current dozen and former researchers from his lab. None agreed to speak. Gary Ruskin, executive director of U.S. Right to Know, which is a nonprofit that says it uncovers government public health failures, told the assembly, that's the journal that wrote this article, "We absolutely abhor any threats of violence against Ralph Barrick or his lab or any other scientists. At the same time, the University of North Carolina owes the public some answers." Ruskin has obtained thousands of pages of emails, chat records, and other communications from Barrick and other researchers, but UNC Chapel Hill denied a request for additional communications between Barrick and the Wuhan Institute, citing a university research exemption from public records laws. U.S. Right to Know has sued the university, and that case is currently at the NC Court of Appeals. A spokesman of UNC said, "UNC takes its commitment to transparency and compliance with public records laws seriously, and accordingly has produced more than 130 pages of records in response to the U.S. Right to Know requests." Barrick, meanwhile, has said publicly that a lab leak was possible, and he signed a 2021 letter in Science urging a full investigation of COVID's origins. He said in his deposition last year, "You can't rule that out." But he also said the odds that a natural mutation caused the pandemic were much greater. No chances even close. One of Barrick's loudest critics is new Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. In his 2023 book, The Wuhan Cover-Up and the Terrifying Bioweapon Arms Race, Kennedy claimed that, quote, 20 years of gain-of-function deviltries have yielded virtually nothing useful to humanity, and called Barrick, quote, the archetype for how the Chinese maneuver U.S. government-funded scientists into transferring bioweapons technology to the Chinese military. While running for president in 24, Kennedy also suggested an 8-year break from NIH funding of infectious disease research, prioritizing chronic illness like obesity and diabetes instead. Since the noted vaccine skeptic has taken office, scientists have been told to remove any references to mRNA vaccines from grant proposals. Congress has not passed new restrictions, but policy changes under Trump and Kennedy are already slowing scientific research. Universities have long used government funding, especially from NIH, to offset the enormous cost of their research. Chris Breyer, the director of Duke's Global Health Institute, says it's one of the reasons why both our science and technology and our research universities are the envy of the world. But the Trump administration has made clear it hopes to change that model. The administration has sought to cap so-called indirect costs, reimbursement for overhead expenses like the biosafety measures that Barrick relies on, at 15%, much lower than universities have negotiated in the past. University-wide, UNC Chapel Hill's indirect cost rate is currently 55%. Though courts have blocked Trump's attempt to pause most federal grants, science funding is still functionally frozen. Barrick has had NIH funding for the entirety of his 33-year career, he said, but, quote, right now some of that funding is on pause and we don't know when it's going to be approved. The only money he knows of coming out of the NIH are one-year renewals of previously awarded multi-year grants. At the same time, other countries are building out their own biopharmaceutical research and development industries to avoid the shortages they faced in the pandemic. What happened in so many other countries was that there was no vaccine available, said Byrus. The model that developed was essentially charity, people giving leftover vaccines, people donating vaccines they didn't want to use. Shifting such research out of the U.S. is a risk in Barrick's eyes, in part because the lack of international regulations over biosafety. In a recent New York Times op-ed, co-authored with a Columbia University epidemiologist, Barrick lambasted his former Wuhan collaborator, Xi, for continuing to do research with the same reduced biosafety measures that launched the worries of a lab leak. Barrick wrote, "This work was apparently approved by local institutional biosafety committee and adhered to national biosafety standards, but it is not sufficient for work with a new virus that could have significant risks for people worldwide." Barrick and his co-author Lipkin called for global standards around biosafety, pointing to the World Health Organization as the de facto leader, but the Trump administration pulled the U.S. out of the WHO, limiting its ability to influence any such effort. U.S. funders could also place biosafety requirements on their international partners, but growing antagonism between the U.S. and China has curtailed such cooperation. The proposed Deterrent Act would prevent U.S. researchers from signing contracts with Chinese institutions. China already imposed similar limits on its scientists in response to earlier U.S. legislative proposals, as well as the prosecution of Chinese scientists and professors accused of spying. Behrer said it has now become all but impossible to get a collaborative research grant funded by any branch of the federal government approved in China. There's no question that that is a really big change, and many of us perceive it to be a significant loss. Despite all the pressure on scientific research, the CEO of one triangle-based company said he is hopeful about the future of biopharmaceutical innovation. That is James Rosen. He leads the rapidly emerging antiviral drug development initiative, READDI, we'll call it READDI, which is a public-private partnership and a, quote, affiliated entity of UNC Chapel Hill. Barrick helped found it, and the $65 million NIH grant he received in 2022 went to a center that is part of READDI. The General Assembly also gave READDI $18 million in 2022. There are 24 families of viruses that cause human illness, Rosen explained, and 8 of them have the potential to cause another pandemic, including coronaviruses, flaviruses like dengue fever and Zika, filoviruses like Ebola and Marburg. READDI is trying to develop 2 broad-spectrum, small-molecule antiviral drugs for each. Rosen says READDI doesn't do cutting-edge work like mRNA vaccines or gain-of-function research. Just old, good old-fashioned blister pack of pills, said Rosen. What we tell people to think about is, wouldn't the world have been a different place if we'd had Paxlovid when COVID emerged? But a great deal of science has to happen before biopharmaceutical companies will step in, said Rosen. The parts of the virus that drugs could effectively target have to be identified, as do the patentable molecules that can target them without causing unwanted interactions elsewhere. Until that work is done, the financial risk is too high for companies to bother. That's why University First officials, scientists, and others are concerned by the Trump administration's move to restrict funding for research. A Duke University study found the likelihood of a COVID-19-level pandemic is about 2% in any given year, meaning another is statistically likely to occur within the next 60 years. A strain of bird flu, H5N1, has been spreading across the globe. It's already caused a pandemic in wild birds, even hitting those on remote islands, said Byron. It infected chickens, then jumped to cattle, a mammal that doesn't typically get bird flu. There have already been human cases, though mostly mild, but earlier this year the virus jumped again, this time to cats, where it has proven much more lethal. A UNC Chapel Hill spokesperson said the school does not conduct gain-of-function research, quote, as it is defined under current laws and regulations, unquote, and the university will adjust as needed if those rules change. UNC Chapel Hill lobbyist Kelly Dockham said she believes that Barrack's work studying virus will continue to receive support in part of what she said was strong backing within the state. She said she's spoken with legislators over the past several years about the need for better antivirals. Former Senator Richard Burr, now a lobbyist for UNC Chapel Hill and Duke, championed multiple pandemic preparedness initiatives while in office. Current Senator Tom Tillis has pushed for increased NIH funding over the last two Congresses. Dockham told the Assembly, Tillis is very uniquely positioned and aware of the significance that this money provides for the entire state. I'm optimistic. Now, am I too Pollyannish? I don't know, but I just know the conversations I'm having in my professional capacity, it gives me motivation and hope. All right, trying to now maintain some cultural spectrums here from the Indie Week, which provides a lot of music, art, drama, etc., articles which I'm often not able to read. Here's one about Rhiannon Giddens, famous musician, and this is a fairly long conversation. For her, music is all about the through line. Sarah Edwards wrote this and published it yesterday. Rhiannon Giddens is speaking from her home office in Ireland, stacks of books and skeins of yarn piled on a shelf behind her. She's speaking about reviving traditional music from the past, and specifically for this conversation, songs honoring the German student protester Sophie Scholl, who was beheaded in 1943 for distributing anti-Nazi pamphlets and finding its resonance in the present. Gibbons has made a career of excavating these historical acts of resistance from Scholl, whose example has clear historical reverberations today, to Omar ibn Said, a Muslim scholar trafficked into slavery in North Carolina, whose memoir Giddens turned into a Pulitzer Prize-winning opera, and drawing them into the present. Recently, Giddens was in the news for her own moment of defiance, deciding not to play the Kennedy Center, after it fired its longtime president, appointed a Trump loyalist, and installed Trump as chair. As a devout student of history, it's no surprise Giddens' next act also has a through line to the past, biscuits and banjos. That's termed a three-day exploration of black music, art, and culture, and it takes place in downtown Durham coming up April 25th through 27th. April 25th to 27th. The event marks 20 years since Black Banjos Then and Now, an old-time gathering, took place out in Boone, North Carolina. There, Giddens and other revivalists, including future Carolina Chocolate Drops bandmates Justin Robinson and Dom Flemons, met Joe Thompson, an Orange County fiddler born in 1918, credited with keeping the black string band tradition alive. The Carolina Chocolate Drops, who will reunite for the first time in over a decade at this upcoming festival, formed in response to Thompson's mentorship as he passed down singular techniques learned from his father and grandfather who were born into slavery. Ahead of this festival, Indy spoke with Rhiannon Giddens about roots music, her new album with Robinson, and getting ready for biscuits and banjos. This is a Q&A type of thing, and I will cunningly disguise my voice so that you can hear both voices. Indy, biscuits and banjos is a few weeks away. Why did you choose Durham, and what are you most excited about with the festival? Answer, Durham and Chapel Hill are really where the Chocolate Drops got started. We met at the Black Banjo Gathering in App State and went down to Joe Thompson's house in Mebane, but when we played together as a trio, we would busk on the street at the Wachovia Building in Chapel Hill and played at all the venues around Durham, Carrboro, and Chapel Hill. The whole area is kind of like our birthplace as a band. Indie Week, you know, broke us out of there as a band. We had barely been a band when Dom was on the cover, and it's really how things got kick-started. I think we mentioned in that article, yeah, we do school shows. We hadn't done school shows, and we wanted to. Then we got all these schools that were packing out February for Black History Month, and, you know, we had to come up with stuff. And that all went into our first record. It felt like a natural fit to come back to the Triangle. Durham, specifically, is a historically Black city. Obviously, that's changed over recent years, but the history is very deep. We were very careful. We talked to people from Durham, like, does Durham need a festival like this? Would Durham be interested in a festival like this? Would we be adding value? When we found out there is a space here, the Art of Cool is gone, Moog Fest is gone, we did our due diligence, and the whole time we've been working with people from Durham and from North Carolina. The whole team is made up of mostly North Carolinians outside of the folks on my team. Question. Durham could use a festival, and this one speaks to a lot of the things the city is at risk of losing touch with. And the festival also has all these other aspects of material culture, food, storytelling. Can you speak to what you see as a relationship between all of these things? It was kind of my dream. Really, biscuits, books, and banjos was the ultimate dream, but biscuits and banjos is shorter and catchier. The idea came about because I was just seeing what was happening in the culture. I call it non-mainstream Black culture, right? This isn't Kendrick Lamar, not Beyoncé, not Black movie makers and stuff. We're on the edges. How do we break through every once in a while? In terms of the music, I wanted it to be a place where that was the center. Instead of us being on a stage somewhere or an act in another festival, all of it is us doing this work. The cultural excavation that a lot of us are doing in this work is also happening in the foodways world. High on the Hog was a big Kickstarter on Netflix. The idea of creating a space where we can cross-pollinate and see each other and meet, and somebody coming in can get an idea of what's happening in general across, you know, I think it's a culture in and of itself. Historically informed art making and food making and books and thinking about how they all come together. These folks have been doing this work, and a lot of them I know very well. It was an idea of, gosh, let's come together and celebrate. Let's come together, not just for a day, come for the whole weekend. Let's have a party. Let's have a dinner together. Let's plot, you know? Let's make a plan of things to do. It's anti, how much money can we make with this festival? It's really, how can we make this a community-based festival, a cultural festival? So it's really about gaining more than a paycheck. We tried to keep the price low for the wristlists, and we have a lot of free programming, which is really amazing, and that was the goal from the beginning. Question. I have that indie story pulled up and wanted to ask you about one thing you said in it. Quote, playing this music is a reclamation, and I think that's happening across the board in old-time music. A lot of youngsters are picking it up because it's something that is real. It's not prepackaged, prefabricated, and spoon-fed to you on MTV. That was 20 years ago. What has or hasn't changed since then? And she answers, I think in general the old-time bluegrass and Americana community has really picked up a lot of momentum. There's a lot that's very exciting about what's been happening, but I also feel that there's been a lot of commodification of the music, and that brings its problems. There's an academization of this music going on in places like Berkeley. Not to throw shade on those institutions, but I want us to be aware of what's happening to this music. All traditional music changes. It changes function. It's dance music. Then it's performance on stage. The Chocolate Drops took dance tunes and we performed them on stage. I'm not saying you can't do that, but we're getting further away from that last generation that grew up connected to the land. I just want us to investigate why we're playing this music still and what we are doing with it. It's something worth saying, but I do want to make sure that we're connected. That's kind of behind the release of this record. What did the blackbirds say to the crow? It's a reminder. Yes, let's play it fancy ways, and let's put on the gear, get on stage and do it. But also let's make sure we're still sitting on the porch and just playing the tunes. I might have time for one more question. I'm curious about whether your new album was recorded and the significance of those places. Well, Joe Thompson's tradition was fiddle and banjo, no guitar, no percussion, just fiddle and banjo, and there's a different sound to the banjo when it's not played with a bass or a guitar. Particularly, Joe's music really was not developed for guitar or bass, and that's why Dom often played percussion instruments with Joe's tunes. I was like, you know, gosh, it would be nice just to have a whole record of fiddle and banjo, and let's do them in the places where the tunes come from. Let's do something from the West in North Carolina, some in the Piedmont, some in the East, because I knew Justin knew tunes from all of those places. So then it was naturally like, well, let's just do Joe tunes that we've never recorded at Joe's house. Joe's nephew welcomed us and fed us, and it was really just a beautiful thing. Then we went to Etta Baker's house in Morganton, and her house has not changed. It's insane. It's like she wandered off one day and never came back. It doesn't have electricity. Literally, her hat is on the rack. Both me and Justin walked in there and almost cried because we're like, Grandma! Her son came out and hung out with us for the day and told us stories about Etta and listened to the tunes. Global music's great, you know. Spotify, as a professional musician, I hate Spotify. As a consumer, obviously, it's great. You can listen to anything anywhere, but there's nothing wrong with, like, taking tunes back to the land, playing them on the land. There's something about playing these instruments outside. The recording was microphone for my banjo, microphone for his fiddle, microphone for the outdoor sounds, and that's it. So, folks, here comes our own little music telling me that it's time to wrap this up. Indie Week had a lot more to say in this article, and I have a lot of back articles that I have not gotten to. I'll try to intersperse them in future recordings. This is a podcast, and it will be available in the podcast album at ncreadingservice.org, and that is our website. And that's where you can find way back issues of Independent. And I am John Feddersen, not quite so way back, but I do intend to be back next week with the next issue of Indie Week. Remember that IndieWeek.com is still online, still available, with lots of articles that we may never see the light of day or the never seen. Anyway, whatever they'll never see, they won't be on this program. There's just no time. But I hope you'll listen to whatever pleases you and come back with us next week. And John Feddersen for Indie Week, saying so long, folks.